Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Thanks for tuning in and being here. Today our guest is Vina Schlegel, one of the first Western Osho's disciples. If you like Osho's robes and hats, you have to thank Vina because she's the lady who made those robes and hats with her own hands. We are going to talk about that, of course, but also we'll talk about the link between Osho and Bodhidharma, a topic that Vina researched quite deeply. This research led Vina to travel extensively to Japan and China and visit the cave where Bodhidharma sat in silence for 9 years before founding Zen Buddhism. I'm so happy to have Vina on the show and I hope you enjoyed it. Vina, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Happy to talk to you.
My pleasure. Vina, as a starter, tell us a bit about your story before meeting Osho.
I was born and brought up in South Africa, but I never wanted to be there. I thought there was a whole big wide world and I wanted to go and see the world. So 13 days after finishing my degree, I left South Africa and never went back. Went to Europe, traveled all over the world, and then was inspired by a friend who had gone overland to India in 1969, just after the Beatles had gone to India. They started something. And when he came back, I thought, wow, this sounds like a great idea. So I went overland to India, but I was actually planning to go on to Japan because I'd loved Japan all my life. However, things changed, and when I was in Goa, this lady came, and she came and she said she wanted to teach us dynamic meditation that she'd just learned when she was in Bombay. So she taught dynamic meditation to us hippies on the beach in Goa, and that was it for me.
So you were in Goa and you were introduced to dynamic meditation. And also, I believe you didn't make it to Japan quite yet at the time. Tell us from that dynamic meditation to how you came to Osho.
Okay. Well, you know, as you know, I'm a huge fan of dynamic. I mean, I remember feeling totally high. I remember walking around going, look, I'm high. And I didn't take any drugs because lots of people were taking drugs and go, although I wasn't really into it. So I eventually ended up in front of Osho in Bombay. He was still in Bombay at that time. At first, I wasn't that impressed. I wasn't really into gurus because too many people had been into gurus, and I was a bit suspicious of that. But certainly this man had something. However, I left after seeing him one afternoon, and I left to go to Delhi because I was going to go back overland with some people. But then I decided to fly back. So I came back to Bombay. But the most extraordinary thing was on the train going to Delhi, I had this most amazing feeling of something else. And inside me, I started hearing, you're not going back to England. And my head said, yes, you are. And inside me, my heart said, no, you're not going back. So in the end, I stayed. We went back to Bombay and I couldn't take that flight. And I ended up staying and I went to the first meditation camp in Lonavala. And at first I was terrified and I nearly escaped, but Osho called me back. And with that personal connection with him, just something inside me melted and I knew that this is where I was going for the rest of my life.
Which year was that, Vina?
1971.
So you had a chance to be with Osho in those days where clearly there were less people around him. He was more accessible. So you could ask questions, you could spend more time with him intimately. out of those early days, is there anything that you want to share with us?
Yes, so much I could write a whole book about that. Well, I think the main thing is, yes, I saw him literally every day. Usually he would invite one or two of the Western people in. Mostly they were Indian people, but there were two or three Western people. And he questioned us so much, and then he like touched the third eye and he asked us how we felt and how we felt about dynamic. And I think the most important thing I want to say is I got the impression that he was trying to work out about things about these strange Westerners. Remember, he had never met Westerners before. And so he was trying to see how we worked and everything. So in a sense, we were guinea pigs because he listened very carefully to what we said and how we felt and everything. So it was just an amazing process. I remember one incident I'll just tell you once. He used to like to go to he used to always sleep in the afternoon. That was terribly, terribly important. And he was never disturbed. And then one day he called me in and he told me I had to sit cross-legged in the garden, leaning against the wall where the head of his bed was on the other side. In other words, there was only about a foot space between us, except it was a brick wall in between. But it's easy to feel his energy. I mean, his energy goes through walls and everything. And so I was terrified because I thought, oh, I'm going to be thinking and thinking and I'm going to disturb him. Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like I disturbed him. And for me, this was an amazing experience. So I meditated on the other side of the wall while he slept. And, there were little personal touches like that all the time, which was so beautiful. And, of course, that didn't happen so much later on, although he still tried to have a personal connection with everybody.
It really gives me a sense of how much Osho was trying to understand the Western mind in order to help people in the West in the later years of his journey. And I know that you were one of the first, or perhaps the very first, and you can confirm that, to open an Osho meditation center in the West. In this case, was London. Did Osho ask you to do that?
Oh, yes, in no uncertain terms. He told me to go and open a center, and I was a bit sort of annoyed because I wanted to stay in India with him. But he was very clear. And he was so clear, he told me even what color scheme to have in the center, like a dark green wool carpet, light green walls, and very light green on the ceiling, because he said green was the color most conducive to meditation. So he was very, very specific. But the most important thing I want to say about that was I said to him, well, listen, I'm a hippie. I don't know anybody in London. I'm not from England. I'm South African. How am I going to find the people to come there? And he said something so amazing. He said, Veena, he said, many of my people are already gathered in London. You just open the center and sit there and I will send the people. And this to me was just so amazing. So that's what I did. I opened the center and sat there and people kept on coming in through the door. I had nothing to do with it. They just kept on coming. So it was a very extraordinary experience. It was the first center in Europe. And from then people contacted me from Europe. The next person was Diksha, contact me from Switzerland, and people from Denmark actually came over to see what I was doing and they went back. So from London, it started spreading out to Europe.
I followed your recommendations, Osho's instructions on the color scheme of the meditation room, because I remember you telling me this little story here. So I painted the room of our home in London, back in London, green, a pale green. Couldn't do the carpet dark green because the carpet was already the beige, but the walls were pale green. And within weeks the energy changed so much and we had such a deep and wonderful meditation. So it definitely works.
Well, I've got a green carpet here. I installed a green carpet in my flat here. Very important.
It's quite extraordinary, as you say, that Osho said, don't worry, open the center and people will come. And as you know, Chetan and myself, we ran Osho meditation events in London for a number of years. And when we started, we were just, you know, a few friends, 3, 4, 5 people gathering. And then over the years, we managed to gather lots of interest and sometimes up to over 50 people doing the dynamic meditation. And it just happened. It's magic. So that's a beautiful thing to share with everyone who is interested in opening an Osho center, running meditation. Don't be afraid. People will just come. Just you put the space and Osho will send you the people.
Absolutely. Totally. That's the way it works.
Okay, Vina, so I'd like now to talk about robes and hats. How did you end up doing that for Osho?
Okay, yes, because we mustn't skip one important point, because for me it was very important too. I was an editor editing his books for 5 or 6 years, and he invited me to sit on the veranda of his house in Lao in Pune and edit there. So I was sitting there editing a book, and actually, to be honest, after 6 years, I was getting a bit tired of it. And then one of the people who worked in the house came, and she got out the sewing machine and she was trying to sew something. And I kind of looked over and I said, what are you doing? She said, the elastic's gone here and this is what he sleeps in and I have to fix it and I don't know how. And I looked at it and I said, I don't think you're doing that the right way. You could do it a better way than that. And she said, do you know how to sew? And I said, yes. So she said, can you do it? So I said, yeah, okay, move over. So I sort of did this in a completely different way. And he was very impressed and he said, wow, this works perfectly. Do some more. So I had to do some more. And then I went back to the editing and nothing happened. And then suddenly, about maybe 3 weeks later, Nirvana, or Vivek, she was then, came in with a robe and she said, can you make this robe? And I kind of went, oh my goodness me. So I said, okay. And he really liked the robe, except he found one tiny little mistake I made, and he looked at it so carefully he found that mistake. But anyway, I started then making the robes, and then within about a month, he suddenly gave me a huge shock, and he said I had to make a hat for him. And there was nothing there. You know, there was a bit of material that had been left over from some Indians who'd been there. So I kind of made this like hood. And he had a photo session that afternoon. That was the first photo session. So after that must have been a test for me because I had to do it in about 2 hours. After that, he gave me some warning and he said, right, I want some more things. And so I was able to run into town, buy some fabric and stuff, thinking, my God, what am I doing, you know? And then it just took off from there. I did that until we left India, actually. It was amazing trying to make some outfits for him to go into America where it would be much colder, because in India it was always warm, of course. And that's when I made that first knitted hat that you can see in those early ranch days. Altogether, it was about 12 years where I made his hats and his robes and the costumes for the photo scenes, which appeared mostly on the book covers.
That's a lot of hard work, I can only imagine, because I know, as you mentioned before, Osho was very peculiar and he would spot any little defect, so you had to be absolutely perfect at all times, spotless.
It was a good Zen training.
Yes. I'd like now to talk about your latest research. I understand that in the last years or so you traveled to Japan and China and you started to look into the link between Osho and Bodhidharma. share with us what you found out and tell us about your visit to the cave where Bodhidharma sat for 9 years in silence before founding Zen Buddhism.
Okay, yes, well, after Osho died, I went to Japan for 5 years to follow on with that Zen connection. But after 5 years, actually, I got very ill when I was in Japan, and then I had to leave. I finally ended up back in England. And then on January the 4th, 2008, my life took another amazing turn because I saw this documentary on the BBC. And it showed some people doing some kung fu on the top of a mountain, and it showed the presenter visiting Bodhidharma's cave, and it was as if I got a hammer on the head and the words came to me, "You must go there." And it was like, okay. And at the end of that 1 hour documentary, I knew without any shadow of doubt I was going there. It took me some while to get there, but finally in end of September 2008, I ended up on this amazing sacred mountain called Song Mountain. And the first day I went up to this amazing monastery called San Huang Zai, which I had seen in the documentary. But the third day I went up to Bodhidharma's cave. And I walked into that cave and I sat down and, it's hard to talk even because I have tears, because it was as if Osho was there, and I just felt the cave was completely full of this amazing, amazing, amazing energy. It was like being in Darshan with Osho, being close to him, but there was also another energy there, and I was totally overwhelmed. It was another one of the amazing experiences in my life. And from then onwards, I wasn't that sure Osho had spoken about Bodhidharma, but quite what his connection was, I didn't know. And then it was maybe about a week later, I was just there for a few weeks then, and I went to a town called Loyang, which is on the other side of the mountain, and there are these most famous Longmen caves. And these were finished in around 625, I think it was. But they had been constructed right through the 500s. And Bodhidharma was there towards the end of 500 AD. And I was just walking along and suddenly I saw the sign, Cave of the 10,000 Buddhas. And Osho had used this phrase, the 10,000 Buddhas, over and over and over again. And I asked people, did they know of any why he was using that? And no, he didn't. So I really started to research that, and I started finding the whole background to this 10,000 Buddhas. But then I found some quotes of Osho when he said he actually walked with Bodhidharma, and I got this idea it was in that area. And if he said he was with Bodhidharma in that life, so we're getting very esoteric here, you know, but for me that connection was very strong. In fact, in his books he says, when I talk about Bodhidharma, I talk as if I'm talking on myself. Our connection is so close. And I feel that Bodhidharma was one of his biggest connections in his various lives. For me, that's where I feel the closest to Osho. And so for me, the energy of Osho is still pure and strong there because nobody really knows about it. And so every time I go there, I go to the Shaolin Temple. I'm too old now to walk up there, but I sit at the base. There's a beautiful, beautiful little temple called the Chuzo Temple. And in fact, this is where Bodhidharma gave his first lectures on Zen, not in the Shaolin Temple, because that actually was destroyed anyway. But this temple has survived. And I always just sit there, which is, you can actually see the cave from there. So I sit at the base there. And the Chuzu nuns, they look after Bodhidharma's cave. So, and it's always as strong for me as ever.
What's unique about Osho is that he encompasses many different paths, and he talks about all those different paths and traditions with such authority. And for some people, Osho is a Tantra master, for other people, he's a Buddhist master, and for you, he's clearly a Zen master. How do you explain this? How is it possible that Osho is master in different traditions for different people?
Because he simply isn't there. It's not coming from him as a person. It's coming from somewhere else. For me, what he's been doing is making all this ancient heritage more accessible and more available for modern man in the 20th and 21st century. Because if you read some of these ancient scripts, basically even I have trouble following them. I don't really know what they mean, and they're all these fancy words and everything. And he brings everything down to earth, and he's using the language that we in the 21st century can understand. He's using examples that we in the 21st century can understand. So he's illuminating these ancient scripts and texts in a way that we can understand, and this is his genius. I mean, this is absolute genius. And whereas some people criticize him and say, oh, he's just a mix-up of all these traditions, this is absolutely not true. He is drawing on all these traditions and explaining to them, because once he said, actually not once, many times he said, all of you people who have come to me have been in past lives in the different traditions, but you have forgotten it. And all I'm doing is lighting that flame of remembrance in you so that you can understand more clearly where your path is. And everybody has a different path. So some people are into Tantra. It's absolutely not my path, but it's their path. Maybe you are a Hasid person in a past life, and that's your path. Maybe you are Buddhist, and that's your path. And so he's just illuminating all these different traditions in a language that somebody in the 21st century can understand, so that each individual person can find their own roots, their own way, their own path. Because he's not saying, I follow my path, never, never, never. He's saying you must find your own way, but I can point you in different directions. So that's why he has talked on so many people. And whenever he does talk, it's not him. He's just tuning in to this huge inheritance, and that's why he can speak on with such authority, because it's not a knowledge that he's speaking. He's speaking about the essence, and only an enlightened master can experience that essence of all those different traditions. Because if his mind was using it, his mind would block that all. But he's not coming from the space of a mind at all. He's coming from this amazing, all I can use is that word essence again, in order to help every single person. Now, it doesn't matter, even if you're here now, there's so many books and tapes. The person like you, Swaram, and Chetna, who never actually knew him in the body, but you can pick it up, because he's touching your heart in certain ways. And this is his genius. This is why, for me, he's, you know, one of the greatest enlightened masters who's ever lived, maybe an equivalent of Buddha and that, because he's had to do a lot of hard work. Buddha had a sort of, all the people around Buddha were similar, but Osho's talking to people all over this world of hugely different traditions and everything, and yet he's pulling it all together.
One of the reasons why we decided to start this podcast is also to show Osho's contribution to the development of human consciousness. And I agree fully with you in thinking that Osho is the greatest genius we have seen in the 20th and 21st century. Let's talk now about your projects. You are author of 5 books. So for all our listeners, Vina wrote 5 books, including a wonderful trilogy comprising A Vanished Road, Glimpses of My Master, and A Mountain in China. I highly recommend all of 3, but I personally read the second one, and it's full of love and devotion and really resonated with me. It brought tears to my eyes. So what are your current projects and plan for the future, if you have any? What are you up to?
I think very beautifully, nothing much. I feel at this time in my life, I've just turned 74, and I now just want to sort of basically sit and do nothing. But doing nothing also means going back to China. I visit China every year, sometimes twice a year. So I will be back there in September. But this time I do have a project. I have found out that it's reasonably easy for me to fly. It'll have to be flying to this place in the desert called Dunhuang. I don't know if you know it. This is one of the biggest Buddhist centers on the Silk Road. The other one was in Bamiyan, in Afghanistan, where that wonderful Buddha was, which was destroyed by the Taliban, tragically. That's the picture on the cover of my first book. But in Dunhuang was a big Buddhist settlement, and in 1933, I think it was, these caves called the Mogawa Caves were discovered, and inside there was this huge treasure of paintings, sculptures, and scripts. Now, first of all, this was the first time that the cave of, at this point it was 1,000 Buddhas, was mentioned. And that was the start of this 1,000 or 10,000 Buddhas. And I want to go there. And also amongst the scripts that were discovered was the entire Diamond Sutra. And this was the first complete text of the Buddha's Diamond Sutra, which was discovered there. It's now in not the British Museum, but the British something or other here in London. And so this is an amazing heritage. And so I want to go and see that. And also there's this incredible desert with this lake that never disappears. And that's about apparently 40 miles from the town of Dunhuang, and I want to go there too. So I just want to sort of still keep up with following those the roots of this phrase about 10,000 Buddhas, and this is where actually it was first used, because some monk had a vision and was told to make this cave full of 1,000 Buddhas, and that's what he did, paintings and sculptures. So that's my project.
Where people can find you if they want to know more about you and your activities or get in touch with you?
I have a Facebook page, Books by Vina. So there you can see all the books, and also 3 books blog at .wordpress.com. So there you can find a connection to the books where I talk very clearly about all of this, and of course in much more detail.
Okay, great. And I will link your Facebook page and website in the notes of the shows. Okay, so we're nearly there at the end. Final 3 questions. Number 1, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Well, I'm very lucky to have a very, very beautiful view from my window. So my routine is get up, make myself a cup of tea, and go back to bed and drink my tea and enjoy the view from my window. And that's probably what I call my tea meditation. And it's the most important time of the day for me. Without it, I'm scattered for the rest of the day. It's my centering. It's my being strong with myself and being in connection with my surroundings in a meditative way.
I can see some patterns here with you guys, all sannyasin who have been with Osho, because in the first episode of the podcast, I interviewed Radha, and her morning routine, the first thing she does every day is preparing a coffee and doing a coffee meditation. It's the Italian version of your
Of my tea meditation, my English tea meditation, yes.
Okay, so number two, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Oh, without doubt, dynamic. I have loved dynamic since the first time I did it. And I don't do it much, but I still occasionally do it when I want to sort of shake myself up and wake myself up if I feel like I'm falling asleep or something. There is just no doubt that this is the most brilliant technique for 20th century man, because we are now not able to sit down quietly and meditate. That's impossible to do. And so to do this energy building technique, where and then allowing that release in the second stage, the breathing gets your whole energy going, oxygenates your body, and the who, of course, this is an old Sufi technique, pounding at the energy at the base of your spine to raise it up so that you can finally get your energy up to the top of your head and out, which is what the whole every tradition advocates and trains you for. And then by the time you get to that fourth stage, you're just meditating without even trying. You know, it's there. And this is, what can I say? It's been the most amazing technique.
Okay, wonderful. So last question. You leave the Osho experiment. What does it mean for you personally to be with Osho today in 2018?
All I can say is that I feel that I have been fortunate enough to imbibe the essence of Osho, and this is how I function in my life. He is there, or this essence is there with me every second of every day, and I still I live my life according to what I have absorbed from him, and this makes my life totally and utterly fulfilled.
Thank you, Vina. Thank you so much. So that's the end of the show. It's been a real pleasure. You shared so much value, very interesting facts. So thank you, Vina.
It's my pleasure. It was wonderful to talk to you, and I'm so happy that you and Chetna are doing what you're doing. I think it's absolutely wonderful. You're the 21st man. We're a bit old now, but you're taking over in an incredibly beautiful way.
We do our best, and we get inspired by guys like you. Thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the show, help us reach out to more people by rating this podcast and leaving a review on iTunes. We would really appreciate that, and it would help us spread the word even further. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you on the next show.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.